Well, maybe we should go ahead and get started.
Sure.
I am standing on the shoulders of my forefathers, Guy and John, to talk a little bit about integral life practice today. And I know that we've been discussing it, including in last Friday's discussion forum. And what I'd be interested in doing today would be sketch out a few aspects of integral recovery that I think have been meaningful to me. One, in the description I wrote up last week for this would be to look at how it is that integral recovery keeps me honest with myself, or at least attempts to do so. And I want to talk a little bit about that historically, and maybe talk for a few minutes and then compare notes with one another, for a few minutes. And then I wanted to shift to talking about, some of the stumbling blocks in integral life practice. And actually, one of the ones that I see is a primary one for me, and I want to share that with you all. It's a discussion that I don't know that we've had yet, this particular direction I want to take it. So I'm hoping that it will be an invitation again for us to just kind of discuss with one another. And then I want to finish up by talking about some of the research on the long-term benefits of integral life practice. And I'll tie it into an article that I'm going to send a link to Heidi, and you'll have access to an article. So that's kind of what I imagine is kind of roughly in three different sections, I guess you'd say. And as I think most of you have been with me before, I like presenting a little bit of material and then maybe talking about kind of unpacking it together. So I really encourage dialogue, and I'm very happy to be kind of the timekeeper to make sure that we move along to cover these three areas over the course of our time, but I'm very happy with fluidity. So with that, let's dive into the fluid. I think first of all, to talk a little bit about a kind of full spectrum, an aqua map and what that looks like in terms of application to our lives. And I'll root it in my own story, but I would imagine there's considerable overlap, and then we can talk about how there is and isn't. Just a word quickly. I grew up in my family of origin. I'm the only one in my family of origin that, from a Jungian typological perspective, I'm the only one that's a feeler. Everyone else in my family, my mother, my father, my two older brothers, and one younger sister, they're all thinkers. And how that went for me is I grew up thinking I was a thinker, and I do okay with thinking. I've made my career, I guess, in terms of thinking in academics, but it became clear to me in my kind of mid-20s, I guess. I was a late bloomer this way in terms of self-awareness, but my mid to late 20s, I became aware that really my primary kind of function between thinking and feeling is much more feeling, much more right brain. And there's a way I'd always known that. I was very drawn to spirituality and a sense of wonder. I was very, very tapped into art, particularly in music, and that was always a primary language for me. But in my family, the idiom was logic, rationality, science. Came from a family that everybody except for me and the family was in the medical profession, and grew up with memories of my father really wanting to groom me to become a physician like he was. So my gifts as a kid growing up were things like microscopes and various science experiments and so on, and I kind of did them, but never was fully into it. Always wanted to play music or go on hikes out in nature and so on. Well, how this translated for me is I went all the way through academics, starting in elementary school all the way through high school, and as I began to apply myself, I was always kind of at the top of my class, and so I was getting rewarded for my intellect. And so it continued in college. I had the same experience in college. In high school, I was a valedictorian in high school. Turned around in college, I was a valedictorian in college. So you can see I was getting a lot of acclaim for my thinking. And it was really my sense of self was rooted in that. I got into graduate school, and between my first and second years of graduate school, I had a huge existential crisis. And it centered around the following, and then I'm going to tie this into life practice kind of thereafter. This would be 1980, to give kind of a date to it. It was the summer of 1980, in between my first and second years in graduate school. There I was in graduate school in these classes. We had 25 students in my class that was admitted. And for the first time in my life, I was in a classroom with all the other valedictorians from their colleges and from their high schools. So there were these 25 students, all of whom were had been reinforced primarily for being good thinkers. And I remember thinking to myself, it was very powerful and very disturbing, kind of thrown off balance experience. But I remember thinking to myself over that summer, after doing the same thing, worked my ass off my first year of graduate school, was top of the class and so on. I remember thinking to myself, have I ever had one original thought? Mm-hmm. And everything collapsed in around that awareness and what attached to that awareness. I came back my second year in graduate school and really have never been the same since. And it really was one of these kind of cataclysmic pivot points in my own life, where whatever was before was radically recalibrated thereafter. I have to tell you guys, it even manifested in some of the most peculiar ways, though they don't seem peculiar in hindsight. My handwriting changed. I went from this very kind of neat, almost like typewriter-like handwriting, probably no big surprise there, to this kind of wild-ass cursive. And it manifested in every realm of my life. It manifested in terms of my taste buds. For the first time in my life, I really liked cheeses that were really rank. And so on it goes. It really is pretty incredible how everything can shift kind of in a moment, it seems like. Well, but nevertheless, I was still in graduate school, and so it's all relative, I guess. So I continued to graduate school. My, by the way, this shift was a radical introduction for me into non-Western religion, particularly Buddhism and Hinduism, and Buddhist practice certainly represents the beginnings of my immersion in Jung and Ken Wilber. All of that's around this time for sure. And but I continued on, and I got out of graduate school. I graduated in the mid-80s from graduate school, and I was hired immediately into a graduate school, a university here in Los Angeles. And so I began as their youngest faculty teaching doctoral students in psychology. And so, like I say, it's all relative. I was continuing to make my living based on my mind, and kind of my mind. Well, I'll tell you what occurred to me. I wasn't sure if I was going to share this, but in my first few years of graduate school, I still remember sitting around a table. It was a big conference table for one of our committee meetings, which were incessant. And it was primarily males. Also, at that point, not a big surprise in academics. That's shifted greatly over the last 30 or 35 years significantly. But I remember one day sitting there and listening to people talk, a bunch of talking heads, including me. And my eyes followed around. If you can picture a long, rectangular, thick oak table with probably maybe 12 to 15 faculty sitting around it. And my eyes fell to the table, and I began following the edges of the table. And what I noticed, I kept this to myself, was that there was one pot belly after another going around the table. And I don't mean to be critical of that. In fact, mine is a pot belly now. I remember thinking, this is my fate, is that I'll end up with a talking head, and the image of the tummies, of the bellies, is more a commentary than anything else on being disembodied. I think that's why it was meaningful to me, is that there was a sense that there were these heads connected to these bodies that they didn't feel like they were really connected to their bodies. And I felt like this was my fate. In fact, this is what I had lived so much, including in my family of origin. So it's not so much a commentary on physique as it is on a connection to body, to embodiment. After 7 years in academics, I took my first sabbatical, and I was offered a position for a year at Pacifica Graduate Institute in the Santa Barbara area. And I was invited there because of my being really steeped in Jung and the work of Joseph Campbell. In fact, when I came there that year, Joseph Campbell bequeathed his entire library to Pacifica, and my office was right next to it. So I used to go over during my breaks and lunch hour and just walk through this massive library that was all of his books. And this is simply as an aside to talk about there's academics and then there's academics. I remember pulling a book off of the shelf that was of interest to me. It was in German. And I spoke a little German at that point. And I opened it up, and there were Joseph Campbell's notes in the margins in pencil, detailed notes. So it was a book in German. His notes were in English. I was really impressed by that. And then the next book over was a book in Latin. And I pulled it off the shelf and opened it up. It was the very same thing. There's these copious marginal notes, highlights, and so on, in Joseph Campbell's pencil. And then I came to realize that I looked around that he was fluent in all these languages, and was every one of these books were books that he had read and studied. It was that left a lasting impression on me. He wasn't kidding. When they bequeathed the library to him, the president of the university, I remember discussing different yogas, different spiritual paths, and he said that Joseph Campbell reached nirvana, so to speak, by sheer intellect, that his path was intellectual yoga. And for sure that was the case. A brilliant spirit as well. But it was that year at Pacifica that represented kind of the next level of integration. This is exactly 20 years ago. I was at Pacifica for the first time for a year. I remember walking, I lived there in Carpinteria, which is where Pacifica is, and I remember walking on the beach every morning down there right along the Pacific Ocean, and began to realize that if I didn't actively intervene, that my life was going to continue to be as unbalanced as it was. And even though I'd had that kind of denouement, that epiphany, over almost 15 years before, I hadn't done much to really integrate a life that was focused on anything other than my brain. And so it was the beginnings. I can remember very, very concretely. I used to run on the beach in the days where I could run. And I remember running, and this was going through my mind, is how could I develop a practice that would be honoring of different significant components of myself, and how could I really kind of track or monitor that to make sure that I don't end up 5 or 10 or 15 years from now being one of those disembodied heads that I had feared that I would become, and I felt like that I was becoming. So I began from that point on, so it's been about 20 years now, of focusing on a practice that for most of those 20 years included four different components, and I'll talk about another component that came more recently. And those four components were simple enough. They were body, mind, soul, and spirit. And so I probably it's part of my, I don't know, I'm kind of sheepish about this, it's probably my kind of obsessive compulsive style or whatever, but I tracked it to make sure that several days a week, and I would track it in my calendar, several days a week, and I had this goal of however many days a week, that I would make sure that I gave at least a half hour. That was just it was a way for me to create some kind of accountability that wasn't too obsessive. At least a half hour to physical exercise. At least a half hour to, in terms of the mind, was primarily reading. It could be developing lectures and these kinds of things, but primarily reading. And that was easy for me because it was reading in psychology and spirituality, and that there's never been a problem with me doing that regularly, a lot. But I had it in there, and then for soul, it was important to me, particularly as a musician, that I make sure that I. It was very easy for me to get caught up in my work and caught up in my head and neglect creativity. And I felt like the creativity was so instrumental to my wholeness and my well-being. And so that was the beginning of my beginning to track and kind of hold myself accountable to a few hours a week of creating. And as I say, it was there was a period of time in which I wrote poetry and that kind of thing, but primarily it was in terms of my composing music and or performing. I compose music at a keyboard, and I'm a drummer. I perform with drumming. And then the fourth area in terms of spirit for me was really sitting meditation. I'd been practicing Zen at that point for probably 15 years, and it was to make sure that I did that. It's very easy for me, continues to be very easy for me, to be sucked into the vortex of task orientation. And so that continued for the next 10 years. What's curious, and some of you will be able to relate to this, curious in kind of a tragic sense, is that my practice continued. And probably about 5 years after this second epiphany at Pacifica, I began experimenting with alcohol and drugs in a way that I never had before. It had a lot to do with kind of some external events and losses in my life, and also kind of where I was developmentally, I think, nearing midlife. And so, as I've shared before, I think I have to be the oldest person that ever smoked pot for the first time. I was about age 45. And the same with experimenting with other drugs, and yet I continued my practice through all of that. It started off kind of a foot in the door. It started off at a minimal level, but became more and more severe. So that about 7 years ago, I really began working actively in recovery and had a very difficult time. I started with kind of a harm reduction approach, and over time came to realize that that wasn't going to work for me. So I needed to move into an abstinence model, and that's where I've been for the last few years. But what I was clear about during this time, and it was simultaneous with Ken Wilber's beginning his coming out with his book with others, the collaboration Integral Life Practice, is that and it was simultaneous also with my getting a sponsor in the 12-step program and working the steps, is that an area that I had neglected with my body, mind, soul, and spirit practice was shadow. That even though I've been in psychotherapy with a Jungian analyst for whom I have the world of respect, we never really talked about my growing addiction. I didn't talk about it. It wasn't for him to somehow read my mind. And I felt like that was a necessary ingredient that I'd been missing. And so we've already talked about this in the last few weeks, that I began then to add shadow practice into every everyday's meditation, and that includes my own recipe for forgiveness practice based in Buddhist meditation, as well as the 12-step work on the moral inventory and making amends and so on. So that's kind of been my daily practice now for about 20 years. It's pretty close to daily. I don't do it every day, but I have believed that just kind of regular practice, regular exercise, regular meditation, the reading is taking care of itself. And more recently, I've had to find myself, it's been challenging for me to invest time in creativity and particularly artistic creativity, and I'm in a phase right now the last several months where I've been very committed to that in terms of particularly in terms of playing music. So I think that's what I want to offer up initially is it's been a way for me to keep myself honest, and also I think that initial insight about have I ever had an original thought back in 1980, and then over the years, am I going to end up just being a talking disembodied head? Those kinds of things led me to want to develop a more full spectrum approach to living my life, and I've done that. I want to mention one other thing that I've gotten out of the habit of doing, but there was a period of time in there which I included in this because it's not my front yard at all. I included in this just household projects. I'm not a big household project kind of guy. If it meant fixing a hinge on a door or putting together a cabinet or something, I was doing that fairly regularly for some years, and I guess maybe I need to, speaking of shadow, I need to maybe think about reentering that. But it gives you kind of the spirit of it, is that I felt like that was part of my integral practice. I didn't have this term for it back in those years. For sure it was informed all along by reading Wilbur and others, but just practical daily household stuff feels like it's part of my practice too. I've included ironing and washing dishes and cooking, things like that, as part of what keeps me grounded. So let me offer that up and invite any comments or questions.
Is everybody there?
Yeah, just thinking.
Yes.
It's Lisa. Yeah, I thanks, Bob, for sharing that. I really went there with you. And
thank you.
Boy, it what jumped out at me, because of course I listen to everything as it's about me. And
sure. Me too, Lisa. Me too.
All about me. I noticed how when I was little, I used to love to do arts and crafts, and I was really good at it, and I loved it. And for a period, I painted as an adult, but I don't do that stuff anymore. I'm going to cry. And what jumped out at me when you were saying that was like, you know, talk about shadow, my creativity in that respect is kind of disowned. And I noticed the thought, there's something wrong with me being so prevalent in my belief system that I think I make that a lower priority because there's no fixing me involved in it. So what I mean by that is like, yeah, if I go running, I'm fixing me. If I meditate, I'm fixing me. But to create something like throw a pot or paint a painting, well, that doesn't fix me, so it's not important. And it just helped me realize how much I run what I do based on there's something wrong with me that needs to be fixed. And as much as I've questioned that belief, and there's just still a lot of Velcro left on that belief. And so, it really helped me to think, you know, maybe I need to reevaluate my practice and do something creative for creative sake.
Oh, thank you, Lisa. I'd like to interact with you about this if I can. First of all, thank you for bringing yourself here. I listen the same way as you. When you and I met last Friday, I listened to all that you shared with me. By the way, that conversation really has stayed with me, Lisa, about the huge, I really deeply appreciate it. Now I've got tears in my eyes, really moved by that. And I'm listening on the one hand to you very intently and right with you, and it goes right in, and it's formative for me and my own life as well. So it goes both ways. I'm really appreciative of not only you receiving this material, because it's risky. I always feel kind of dorky talking about it, to be honest with you. I don't really talk to anybody about this because I'm so flipping private about this stuff, so it's very vulnerable to me. Even what I've shared with you, it's not what I talk about with anybody. Most people don't have any idea that I do this kind of stuff. It's on my own. So you first of all affirm by just being present and receiving it. And then secondly, to open your own vulnerability, your own kind of leading edge. I'm very appreciative of that. I think what I want to do is I want to come back to the content of what you've shared, because it's actually very integrally related to what I was going to move to in a moment, but I want to invite other comments first. And what I want to move to in a moment is looking at stumbling blocks. And in fact, for me, the greatest stumbling block, and I think it's really tied into what you just said, but I think I'd like to hold off on that because that's kind of a whole other little piece here. So let's check in with others, first of all, maybe your responses to Lisa and or your own kind of self-reflections, and then we'll shift in maybe three or four minutes to talking about stumbling blocks, in particularly in response, kind of riffing off of what you just brought to us, Lisa. Thank you for doing that. Yeah.
Hi, Lisa. I really related a lot to what you just shared. And I was looking at the email that you sent where you laid out your the practices and your quadrants. And what came into my mind was like, wow, this girl is busy, man. You know, there was so much going on there, and I wish I can somehow devote the time to all that. I just don't know what it is that I'm actually looking for or trying to fix. I mean, I feel like I'm really off balance because I spend a lot of time on my physical practice. And what I mean by that is stuff that really brings me centering, really grounds me. And that's just really intense bouts of exercise, high intensity exercise, CrossFit type stuff. And that to me devotes, you know, take 2 hours a day on that. That centers me. My life kind of revolves around that. I do yoga a couple of times a week. I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning most days of the week, 5 out of the 7 days of the week for sure. And I sit quietly for 30 minutes. Other than that, I don't have any way to put any other practices into these quadrants. And I don't even know what those practices are. A lot of the stuff that was in that plan that laid out, I have no idea what it is. So I'm really impressed by that, what you do. And I would like to hear some more about what kind of practices fall into those quadrants. Like, how do I, you know, I'm just right now starting to become acquainted with this idea of shadow. There's this thing about me where I'm like deeply fearful of rejection, right? And it's to the point that it's just like pathological. Like, I'll go over a conversation I had with a client and everything is fine, but I'll have a way of like, there's this sort of, and I don't know what the root of it is. There's this sort of, I think I took a lot of hallucinogens when I was in high school, a lot. And going through a high school day, tripping on LSD, brought on a lot of emotions, you know, and most of it was this sort of inward drawn rejection. Like, you know, my parents had moved cities. So all of a sudden from 9th grade to 10th grade, I was in a completely different world. And it was in that world that I started to experiment very heavily with psychedelics. So I would go through my high school day tripping, and there was this inwardly drawn sense of intense rejection. Somewhere in that, I found some pleasure in tripping, you know, but a lot of it was this deep-rooted sense of not fitting in. Like piercing, not fitting in. Like, I remember, you know, and I seem to have carried that into my adult life. You know, I seem to have carried that intense feeling of not quite fitting in, fear of rejection, you know, and I'm starting to become very, very much aware of it now. And when it comes up, I become aware of it. And I just simply release it and say, dude, it's really like, just let it go. It's okay. Like, it's okay to be human. Like, it's fine. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to have the perfect answer or the perfect response or the perfect interaction to where you're just pleasing everybody at all times. It's okay. You're human. People don't please you all the time. No one has the perfect responses for you all the time. So it's okay, just, you know, and that has brought me some relief and some peace, and it has alleviated some of that. But those are just one of the aspects that I'm starting to become aware of, and I wish there was a way that I can become aware of more of those, because I know that there's this unconscious programming that has been running my life, and just because I have, you know, 3 years clean, it's still there. It's still strong. I want to become aware of it. I want to become more aware of it. I just don't know what the process is to start uncovering that. Mm-hmm. You know, I know meditation has done me a great deal of good, but I still feel that there's a lot of like deep shadow work in there, and I just don't know how to access it. You know,
Emily, I appreciate very much what you're saying. I want to step in for just a second. What you brought up is it deserves its own series of discussions, including I feel what I'm thinking. What I want to do is I want to loop back now and address what Lisa brought up, but I don't want to ignore what you just brought up. And my thought is, I wonder if there's a way in this Friday's discussion forum that you could reintroduce this, particularly around what you've just shared, which is around, among other things, around shadow and what are some of the approaches to working with shadow that those of us that are involved in this practice are doing? What has worked for us? And I'd love to tie it in specifically to what you just talked about in terms of your own self-esteem, your own, thoughts about yourself and so on. Would that be okay with you?
Sure.
I'd like to do that. We won't have time to do that and for me to address what Lisa brought up today. It's just a matter of time, and I'm sorry about that, but I really want to honor what you brought up. I feel like that we've got two big chunks here to deal with, and we probably have time to deal with one of them, kind of, sort of. So if that's okay with you, I'd like to do that. So let's continue the conversation.
Real quick, can I just say something to Hamlet? Hamlet, if you'll email me your address, I have a great CD set by Robert Augustus Masters called Overcoming the Shadow, and it has a lot of exercises in there for uncovering. I mean, the shadow in and of itself is not seen by us. It's not what we don't like about ourselves. It's what we don't see about ourselves. So it's like he has some great strategies for that as well. I'd be glad to mail that to you. Just send me your address.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's a wonderful idea. And maybe what we can do is if you get a chance to listen to that and work with that, Hamlet, is to bring it back to the community here, as well as, Lisa, your own background and expertise in that. I think that'd be wonderful. Yeah. That's a big piece. In fact, you see it implied in what I shared, is it was the one area, what you're talking about, Hamlet, in terms of you're being so impressed by what Lisa is doing, and it is so impressive. I had my own version of so many things I was doing. The one thing I was neglecting is what you just brought up, which is related to shadow. And so that deserves a lot of work. And it's been such a, if I can use this term twice, it's been such a shadow in the transpersonal or integral movement historically. I think it's been corrected in the last years with roadmaps for dealing with shadow, but it's plagued the Jungian community, it's plagued the New Age community, it's plagued most spiritual traditions, and it's plagued the early days of transpersonal / integral work, is that for it to truly be integral, it must address just what you brought up. So we'll spend more time on that. What I'd like to do is loop back to Lisa, what you shared. Give me just a second here. I want to gather a thought or two. I'll share with you guys something. Lisa, I was very touched by your talking about what it is that you do and what it is that you feel like you may be missing. I could very much relate. If it wasn't clear from before, I think I used the term getting sucked into the vortex of task orientation. It's what I do so easily. It's really the path of least resistance for me. And it's not all bad news. There's a lot of good that comes from that. But it's the out of balance aspect of it, that quality of it, back to those images I shared with you from early insights in graduate school, both as a student and then later teaching in graduate school, where it just feels like life is out of balance. And one of the pieces for me, and I want to tie this in if I can to what you shared, Lisa, is something that I've thought a fair bit about, is that it's tricky, and I hope that this can also encourage discussion. It's tricky, this business of engaging in practice. It's even implied in what you said, Hamlet, is that you're a busy man. You get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and you meditate for a half hour. You spend at least a couple hours a day engaged in intense body work, et cetera, yoga during the week and so on. And so you have all this going on. Lisa has a whole litany of things that are part of her daily diet, and I've had my own version of it, which I just shared with you. But how do I do that? How do we do that? How do we engage in integral life practice as limited human beings, for one thing, and also how do we engage in integral life practice without turning it into another, I'm thinking of Guy right now, without turning it into another way of doing? Guy in his book is focusing on being, that recovery requires a shift of orientation, and that he actually indicts in his book approaches to recovery that are overly focused on doing, doing, doing at the expense of being, being, being. I regularly if not daily, regularly, we'll read some out of Lao Tzu. And Lisa, you and I have talked about this. I love Stephen Mitchell's translation. It's a very liberal translation of the Tao Te Ching. And I was reading just this last week a passage that has been one of my favorite passages for a few years. I guess it's favorite because I should be listening to it. And it's just two sentences, and it's this. The master leads by emptying people's minds and filling their cores. The second sentence is the key for me. Practice not doing, and everything will fall into place. When I come to integral life practice, I tend to do what I do with integral life practice, what I do in the rest of my life, and I've come to think of it as, it's like a heroic approach. I'm a hero in my own mind. And how that heroism manifests is that I've got this list of things that I value doing, but my accountability turns into expectation and almost a sense of entitlement. So then the question arises, what do I do when I'm not able to exercise? What do I do when I'm, for whatever reason, not able to settle into meditation? And there's various ways of managing that. Sometimes I think that John has suggested kind of redoubling one's efforts. Sometimes you make up for lost time. But for me, and I don't know if this resonates for any of the rest of you, for me, there's such a risk for me is that I can turn all of this practice into what so much of what I've done in my life. The same boy that got straight A's through high school and college wants to get straight A's with integral life practice. And there's something fucked up about that.
Yeah.
For me. And I just want to hold the space for that for a few minutes with you all. I have nothing more to say about that other than can we invite in our humanity and hold even this practice, whatever form it takes for you, Hamlet, Victoria, Sally, Bob, Lisa, Heidi, how can we hold this in a way that itself is in balance with what Lao Tzu is saying here, which is practice not doing? Just any reflections and you know what I'd love? I'd love to invite Sally and Victoria and Heidi, since the other three of us have spoken. Any thoughts from you all, first of all, about not doing vis-a-vis integral life practice?
Hi, it's Sally here. Thanks for everything said by everyone so far. Massive identification with everyone. But I wanted to answer the question that Bob just put, really, which is
thank you.
Coming from a place of, well, that has had to be my practice for the last 8 years. I've had you know, a serious debilitating illness, and having been, as I, you know, I said before on this call, a really driven, active person.
Yes, yes.
I have been put into the place where I had no option at all,
right.
Physically, mentally, and of course, it's been difficult. It's been really difficult, but I think it, when the external, most external solutions, stroke, opportunities are closed down to you, then you have to really go within and work inwardly.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying, hey, I've got that stuff, because I certainly haven't. But what I'm trying to say is it's been a huge gift, a painful gift, but it's been a huge gift because a lot of the time, not always, I have not had any external options. Mm-hmm. So, I haven't been able to spin off into the vortex of task orientation or, you know, into thought proliferation because I've been too brain fogged, whatever. So that I'm just offering that. It can be really helpful sometimes to just to force it, actually. You know, it's a, that's a Buddhist practice, isn't it? Force of will sometimes to just say, stop.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Sally. Thank you. You know this deeply from the inside, and I can feel it and know it from previous conversations, but that's you're really speaking into what it is that each one of us, there's a book out in the Jungian circles, the title of which comes to mind, and it's a book on Jung and views of faith, religious faith, and the title of the book is The Illness That We Are.
The Illness That We Are.
That every one of us carries limitation, and I love how you're affirming that that if we can be guided by that limitation into an interior relationship to it, and if it can perhaps slow us down and center us inward, that it can be really really useful. And it's as I listen to you, it's the opposite of my kind of Icarus-like heroism. It really, it can ground us, and I know you know this well. Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Well, just quickly, do you have the author of that book, The Illness That We Are?
It's many years ago. I think the author is Dourley, Dourley. I think he might be a British Anglican priest.
It's been many years.
I don't own the book anymore, and I think it was Dourley, and you can probably correct me when you find out, but that's what comes to mind, maybe Brian Dourley. And it's an affirmation of finding faith in the darkness, and there's so many resources. Joan Halifax's book, A Fruitful Darkness, comes to mind. All of us have our favorite books. My first book that I ever read by Jung was Answer to Job. Just read the book of Job, you know, in terms of finding a way into this. I wanted to open it up also to Heidi and to Victoria. Any reflections that you all might want to share?
Well, this is Victoria. Yes, certainly. Wow. So much here, and I do so closely identify with the heroism. I'm a one on the Enneagram, so I want to get it right. And I'm really old. I'm 70 years old, so I've been doing this stuff for a long time and doing a lot of shadow work and a lot of therapy and, you know, just work in all these different quadrants because I want to be the hero in life and get it all right. But I just recently had an illness, not nearly as dramatic as Sally's, but it was about a 6 weeks that it took me to get through the recovery process.
Yeah.
And as I went into that, very early on, I was in the hospital and I just had the sense, I cannot keep living like this.
Yeah.
I was aware of that I was a human doing, and I had all these things that I needed to get done, including the practice, the meditation, the exercise, all of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And so for me since then, there has been a real focus on surrender and accepting God. So much more a movement toward, in the moment, responding to what I'm being called to do. It's even down to the point of finishing something at my computer and just asking the question, what next? And that doesn't mean that I don't plan. It doesn't mean that I don't, that I'm not aware of all these quadrants and, you know, that I want to do a certain amount of meditation in the day and a certain amount of exercise and all those kinds of things. But my life is also such that it's very difficult to schedule it perfectly. So I'm allowing much more of a flow now, and it's a little bit uncomfortable because I don't have that sense of doing it right. But I also find as I let go, it all gets done.
Mm-hmm.
So just kind of dropping that in as a place that I'm just beginning to explore more now.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Victoria. It's really, in the spirit of I think what Sally is proposing. I think it's invited by the kind of questions that Hamlet and Lisa and I are asking. Really appreciate it. Really a deepening into. It's like how to hold integral life practice since that's our topic, how to hold that in a way that respects all the value of exercising these quadrants and these developmental lines and working the shadow, and yet not turning that into another project that keeps us away from our deepest, truest self. It's really a trick. And Lisa, it was kind of implied in something you said earlier. You and I are both. I love our sharing about our respective paths through recovery. It's so much part and parcel of what got me into addiction. And so it's not okay when the solution becomes the problem.
I gotta say, part of me is really confused because I don't do a lot, and I actually still feel that I'm trapped in the same task-oriented judgments, because I hear all you guys saying how much I do, and I actually don't, but it's not because I'm busy being, I'm ashamed that I don't do very much. Like, I know from, like, I don't work a full-time job. I don't have a busy schedule. I spend whole days walking in the woods. And I am actually ashamed of that, that I'm not more productive. So even though I'm not doing all that you guys think I'm doing, I might as well be doing that, because I still think my value is I need to solve what's wrong with me so I'll actually be productive. Because there's a lot I could express and creative desires that I have. And sometimes I just can't get up off the couch because there's so many thoughts that hold me back. So it's funny, the vision of, like, the stuff on that paper doesn't take a lot of time. Trust me, I have tons of hours in my day. And when I spend it being, I don't even let myself have that a lot of the times because I beat myself up for it. So, you know what I'm saying? So it's not like I'm saying, oh, you guys, I don't do a lot. I'm actually very good at being. I'm not. Even when I have so much space in my life, I shame myself that I'm not productive enough.
Yeah. Thank you, Lisa, because I want to withdraw projections from you. I don't want to be projecting onto you kind of all my unlived stuff.
But it's the same thing. It's true. I set like a standard as if, you know, the fact that my life doesn't require me to have a busy schedule, I can sort of make it what I want. Yeah. I could be celebrating that, or I could be suffering about that.
Yeah. I appreciate the way that we're kind of fine-tuning this, is that we can have open schedules, we can have very hectic schedules. It's not a function of schedule, it's not a function really of what we're doing. It has much more to do with the how. It's like the state of mind or the orientation towards this. And I think every one of us has our version of that. You can engage in this practice and feel a sense of lightness with it. You can engage with it and feel this sense of burden with it. And it's the same practice, the same, we can have an open schedule and feel burdened by an open schedule. I can sometimes move through work. In fact, one of my aims is to move through work with a sense of lightness. And that's where it's possible. It's very possible.
That's where I was confused, is because I can experience a really busy day, but it feels more like being, because it's coming from my passion.
Yeah.
So it is an orientation. It's what I believe about what I'm doing. It's more important than what I'm doing.
Yeah. I remember years ago being at a meditation workshop, and the presenter was talking about how we should calm down. And I remember reflecting on this, and people have asked me, if you guys ever see me drum, I don't drum in a calm way. except that when I'm drumming, if I'm in a certain state, and it's very much in the spirit of what we're saying here, I can be moving a million miles a minute with all four limbs operating kind of independently and loudly, and I'm in a state of absolute equanimity in the center of the storm. That's very desirable to me, and I've used that as kind of a metaphor. Is it possible for me to move through my day the way that I drum, when the drumming is really coming from a kind of a fluid channeling kind of place? That's not a bad way to live, and that's certainly not calm, at least from the outside. It's calm on the inside. So it makes it clear to me that we have to be careful about judging interiors from exteriors. That you really don't know if I'm calm or not until you talk to me.
Yeah.
That's funny.
You guys, I'm aware of time, and we have just a couple of minutes. Maybe I'd like to invite Heidi, if you have any thoughts, Heidi.
Okay.
And then we'll wind down.
Okay, I'll just be brief, and I was so mad because I got dropped from the call when you were talking a lot about, I think it must have been heroism, hearing what you guys said, but I did catch the last question about just being, and I think I get the gist, and I just wanted to say that certainly the bedrock of my practice is my just sitting with myself, you know, for an hour every morning with brain entrainment going, and I've been doing that for about 6 or 7 years now, and it's really changed everything. So it's sort of like Victoria said beautifully about the surrender, and Sally was saying that too. But I love, as long as I can sit for an hour with myself, I don't even necessarily try to meditate. I don't have necessarily, I mean, I hope at the end I might have a few moments with no thoughts at all, but mostly I just sit with myself and sort of, lately it's been feeling like sitting in the soup where I just let everything roil around and but in that hour, drinking my tea too, I can just feel like, is today going to be, you know, do I desperately need to go for a walk today, or, you know, do I really want to get a lot done today, or is it going to just be one of those days where I actually feel like shit and I don't really, if I can just get through the day, that's going to be all I expect, you know, and but it's so to feel the day in that, you know, get down into delta states with the brain entrainment and then just feel what wants to happen that day. That to me is, that just guides my life. That's definitely the, and so I think that's sort of just a being. It's just, just sitting there for an hour feeling what wants to happen. And sometimes it will go into shadow work, or sometimes I'll just be thinking busy thoughts or whatever, but it always has a big effect on stabilizing my day. And then if I miss a day, that's how I can tell, because then that day is just not as grounded.
Yeah.
Wow, it just sounds like whatever you do from that place, you do it with integrity, even if it's nothing. It's like nothing or everything.
Yeah, and I certainly, the days are best when I do, you know, if I'm washing the dishes, just take time to just feel how I feel, you know, just feel what's going on. And I don't know, then life is kind of good. And of course, I always am reading, even if it feels bad and you want to push it away, don't, you know, so I'm always struggling with that. But yeah, just taking time out to really feel yourself versus in relation to your world.
I really like what you're saying, Heidi. I really appreciate it. I need to take a lot of notes and learn from you. I'm thinking at least of our conversations, and I understand that we're both sevens. I don't know how that manifests for you, but it manifests for me in terms of a kind of greed. I want everything now. And so, Heidi, you're the antidote to how
it is. I get that way too, but boy, I just want to do everything. In fact, my whole pages of lists, I could just practically kill myself if I could just get them done that day. You know, I want that too. But that's where just sitting with the brain entrainment every day, I swear it mellows everything out, and allows one to surrender better, easier.
Yeah, it's great, you guys. I really appreciate your contributions today. May this be kind of an ongoing, unfolding dialogue over time, for sure. I have a homework assignment for everybody.
Cool.
Let's all go back to non-doing. Also practice non-doing. Thank you all. Take really good care, and we'll see you on Friday, okay? Really appreciate your accommodating this earlier hour today. Thank you so much. Yeah. Blessings to everybody.
Thanks, Bob. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.